Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
We're back. It's 12 after. Thank you very much for hanging around with us. And if you just tuned in, we're glad you're here. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And Joan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jim. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
You're pretty excited too, aren't you?
Very.
Joan, the lead on in the Kiplinger letter this week is about the upcoming, hopefully upcoming election, and the lead up to the election and the aftermath, the possible aftermath issues of the election in Iraq coming up on January 30th.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, you know, this isn't a rosy scenario here by any means. So the good news is that we're saying that the elections will go ahead as scheduled. They will not be postponed. So they will be held on January 30th. But I guess the more difficult task lies ahead after the elections are over to keep, you know, to increase stability in the country.
President Alawi recently said, this week said, that some parts of Iraq will not be safe for voting.
Yes, I know. I noticed that.
Yeah.
Well, he said they're not safe for voting now. I guess he's hoping that maybe they will be safer by January 30th, because we still do have a couple of weeks.
Right. And, you know, and of course, it was one of my predictions, Joan, was that the election would be held on January 30th. There's really, this election is more than it has at least double meaning, if not more meanings, Joan, as you know. One is just getting the Iraqis to the polls to elect their own government. But the other thing is, this is the making the election happen with any level of success is a moral victory, will be a moral victory for people who want freedom in Iraq against the terrorists.
Well, yeah, let's hope.
Because I mean, that's what it is. I mean, it's not a matter of whether this can't be moved. The election can't be moved. If that election doesn't take place on January 30th, the insurgents will be able to say we are winning.
And even if the election takes place, they may be able to say that at some point anyway.
Well, and now who's winning is still, that may still be, you know, yet to be determined.
Right,
but they will have. That would be an indicator to them. I mean, that would be a major PR accomplishment for the insurgents, the people who hate freedom, who hate democracy, who are fighting against this election over there, and a free Iraq, a democratic.
Yeah, but
Iraq.
By the same token, you can't let the elections go ahead if you really are concerned about serious problems in too many areas. I'm assuming at this point they figure if they have problems, it's going to be in such a limited number of areas that it won't harm the results.
Well, and the truth is, Joan, the people that I know who are over there, you know, say that most of Iraq is not. There's not a problem with voting in most of Iraq.
Most is 50 plus one. So, I mean, yeah. I hope they mean 95 or 99.
Well,
if it's anything less than that, I think, hold on a minute. If there's anything less than that, I think you have a problem. I think you do have to consider postponing.
Yeah. Well, they may not, let me put it this way, they may not like the results of the election, but that election is going to happen on January 30th, one way or the other. But, you know, Joan, I will say that 20 months ago, or let's say a year ago, 18 months ago, once we had control of Iraq and Saddam was deposed, who would have thought that in the beginning of 2005 we wouldn't have control of the road between Baghdad and the airport?
That's right.
That is a shocking thing to me to know, but it's costing us, according to you, to Kiplinger folks. It's costing us, what is it, Joan, $100 billion just for the year 2005?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and the total, the start-to-finish bill, Kiplinger predicts, is going to be around $450 billion. Now, Joan, if you take that number and you talk about it in terms of this year, that's a lot of money.
It is.
If you take that money and the other costs that we've had, and we know what those are, and if we were able to look into the future and see a free democratic Iraq flourishing, being a model for the way people live in the Middle East, and then being able to export that, say, over the next 10 to 20 years, that turns out to be a good investment, doesn't it?
That's a good point.
And I think and I'm not trying to play the glad game here and be the Pollyanna, Joan, but to me, we can't talk about the negative without giving the possibility of the positive a chance.
Well, I wouldn't want to do that, but I wouldn't want to overlook the negative if it's an important factor in what's going on.
Well, of course, the negative has the benefit of being right in front of us, doesn't it?
Well, sure.
And the positive is something we've got to hope for. And
yeah,
so
that's right.
The main job that the U.S. has to do, Joan, and you guys talk about this on page one, is you've got to prepare the domestic security forces. We've got to figure out how to get the Iraqis to fight for themselves, don't we?
Well, we've got to figure out how to keep the domestic security forces from getting murdered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's the first. I mean, you talk about looking at the positive and the negative, but if the negative is killing you, then you have to face it and do something about it.
The interesting thing to me, Joan, is it's one thing for the insurgents to target and harm Americans, and I can see how the Iraqis would take one attitude about that. Maybe they wouldn't like it. Maybe they wouldn't be indifferent to it. But when you've got a case where the insurgents are killing, you're an Iraqi and they're killing your son who's trying to make your country a better place, or they're attacking people in funerals. Remember that one a week or so ago?
Right.
They actually blew up a funeral and killed a bunch of people who were attending a funeral. I mean, at what point in time did the Iraqis stand up and say, you know what, this isn't about the U.S., this is about us, and you're hurting us?
Well, you raise an interesting point when you use the term the Iraqis. I mean, it's my understanding that the Iraqis have long-standing dissension within the country between the Sunnis and the Shiites. Then yep. You also have the Kurds.
That's right.
You could talk about an Iraqi saying that I don't like the insurgents because I'm an Iraqi, but maybe that person is a Sunni and they're right. Happy that the insurgents are fighting against the Shiites.
Either way, Joan, 2005 is going to be a very interesting year in the Middle East, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Stand by. We're going to take a quick break. It's 20 after. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. We're visiting with our good friend Joan Pride, senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Stay with us.
Right into space. On the roof is peaceful as can be.
They come from the cities and they come from the smaller towns. And beat up cars with the tires and drummers go crack.
We're back at 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Joan Pride is our guest, and she's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Joan, one of the things that that Kiplinger points out this week is that 2005 is going to be, with regard to Bush's Iraq policy, the U.S. and the coalition Iraq policy, 2005 is going to be a make-or-break year, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, no question about it.
If this election, even when the election is pulled off, if it's not reasonably attended, reasonably successful, and then of course there's always the chance that there, you know, who knows what will happen. The one thing about it, Joan, it seems to me that the key to success in Iraq in 2005, politically speaking, is for the Shias to quickly, after the election, regardless of what happens, to quickly reach out to the Sunnis, which are about 20% of the population, a minority, a clear minority, and also the group that typically are seen as the insurgents, to quickly reach out to the moderate Sunnis and say, you know, folks, no matter what happened in the election, you know, we want you to be part of this. Let's let's get together. That's, to me, that seems to be the only way to avoid a civil war.
It sure looks that way.
Yeah. Joan, the Kiplinger also says, though, that by the end of this year, that things should be improving over there. And I hope you're right. Joan, let's move over and talk. Let's change the subject. Let's move back to the United States and talk about taxes. Now, this is an area that you focus on a lot. Tell us what Congress is going to be doing about the tax breaks that we already have.
Well, we've got a lot on the tax horizon next year. You know, a lot of the tax breaks we have now, such as an increase in the child credit and a wider tax bracket and bigger standard deduction for married couples, and also even the lower rates on capital gains and dividends, all of those tax breaks have expiration dates coming up. And what the president wants to do is make all of those tax cuts permanent. And we think that Congress will go ahead and do that this year.
Well, and you know the reason I think you're right?
Why?
It's because that's what I predicted too.
Oh, great.
So that just adds extra validity to your argument there, Joan.
Well, right. And I'm just getting started here. That's just the beginning. The other thing is the state tax repeal. As you know, the death tax, right?
Yeah.
The state tax law is kind of weird because it phases out over several years and is repealed in 2010. But due to the craziness of the budget situation, it comes back in 2011. So what they're trying to do is...
What's wrong with that picture, Joan?
Everything.
Yeah.
So what they're trying to do is what we're calling permanent estate tax repeal. And we think that the problem in terms of getting that through has always been in the Senate. And we think that they are close to getting enough votes, and by enough votes we mean 60 votes, to head off a filibuster and get that passed.
Well, and the last number I looked at, Joan, was that estate tax nets us about $50 billion a year. Is that a number that you know?
I'm not familiar with that number, but I'll believe you if you want.
It's my understanding that seems high, though, doesn't it? Anyway, the point, regardless of what the number is, it's a number that's significant enough that the government doesn't want to do without. They've gotten addicted to those funds. So by slowly but surely, doing away with it over a period of what would we turn out to be about 8 years. You wind up weaning yourself off of it, so to speak.
Yes.
So hopefully we will have found a way to survive without those funds, so that when people die, their estate isn't taxed on the things that they've earned and have already paid tax on.
Right.
It's a repressive tax that should not even be in existence for rich people or poor people. You should not have to pay taxes because you died. The event of your death shouldn't create a tax, a tax situation, that a taxable event, as they call it, you have to pay taxes on assets that you've already paid taxes on to earn them in the first place.
And is this the end of the soapbox portion of the program?
What soapbox? No, I'm sure there'll be at least another one.
Well, my theory about all this is, I think the problem is you're transferring wealth, and I'm not saying I agree with such a tax, but it's interesting to me that the heirs, you know, normally when you get income, any kind of income, you pay tax on it. But if I get an inheritance, I don't pay any tax on it. That tax has already been paid out of the estate. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I'm guessing that that's the theory behind that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe so. But of course, as you and I both know, the people who have the serious money have the ability to avoid this by
estate planning. Yeah.
Yeah, by the machinations, and the people who get really squeezed are sort of the people in the lower end of the estate tax bracket, and they're typically not savvy about these things. They're savvy about these things. Their estate's not big enough to create a huge trust, and they wind up getting hit. So a lot of times the farms have to be sold, or the small businesses have to be sold, and I'm against that. Four square against that, folks. And I know you'll be surprised to hear that. Joan, let's take a quick break. We're going to be right back after these messages. It's 29 after. The show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot.
Your name and lights above it. This is your big debut. It's like a dream come true.
Talkers Magazine calls Jim Blasingame one of the best talk show hosts in the industry.
Now remember, I do my best work when I'm being worshipped as a god.
He's Jim Blasingame, the small business advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after. Thank you for hanging around with me. My website is www.jbsba.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my free newsletter, and this will be a good week to do it because this is the week when we launch our 2005 Small Business New Year resolutions for your small business and my small business. And you're going to get the whole laundry list of major topics that we're going to talk about in the next, over the next several weeks. You're going to get the long list today, which would be handy to use to print out and to hold on to. And then in the weeks ahead, we're going to take each one of the seven major categories and be more specific in the letter. So this would be a great week to get you started as a subscriber to our newsletter, and I hope you'll go there at jbsba.com. And, of course, it's free, and, of course, it comes by email on Sunday to get you ready for the week ahead. So I hope you'll do that. That's at jbsba.com. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kipling Editors. We're talking about what's going on in the world compared to, or I should say, based on what the good folks at Kiplinger have to say, and it published in the Kiplinger letter this week. Joan, the airline industry is in the news again this week, aren't they?
Boy, is it ever.
It's important, isn't it, Joan, to sort of identify the two major categories of airline companies. One is the legacy carriers, U.S. Air, Delta. Is United still in business? I forget.
Yes.
They took bankruptcy. I guess they're still in business.
Yes.
American. Those are the legacy. Northwest. Those are the legacy carriers, which sounds like a nice name, but it's actually not, is it, anymore?
No, not,
and
not at all.
The other one are called the discounters. And, Joan, I heard today that it costs a discount airline 7 cents per seat per mile to take you down the road.
Okay.
The seat you're sitting in, every mile you go costs them 7 cents, the discounters. The legacy carriers, it costs 12 cents per seat.
Now, why is that? Is it union contracts or what?
It's labor and stranded costs. They probably got a lot of, you know, a lot of old, maybe some older airplanes that need higher maintenance.
Oh, right.
You know, it's a combination of things, but mostly I think it's payroll.
Yeah.
Because it feels the same, isn't it?
It sure should be. Yeah, absolutely.
Although, Joan, the newer airline, the newer planes, and the smaller ones. You know, most of the discounters fly the smaller planes.
Right.
And they're not only newer, but they're more efficient. They're more fuel efficient.
Well, that's important nowadays.
Yeah. So this is a real challenge, isn't it? You know, this is not unlike, Joan, the utility industry, the electricity industry, where they have these stranded costs.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Telephone companies.
Yeah.
Very similar. These are all legacy members of their industries, and we're in a transition period, and those people are having difficulties, aren't they?
Well, that's true. They definitely are.
So what I'm wondering about, you know, Delta took the lead in lowering fares recently to match
right.
the discounters.
And we're saying that others are going to follow suit.
Right. So what's going to be the outcome of all that, Joan?
Well, boy, you know, the last thing they need is even less money coming in, so I don't think it looks good.
Well, you know, of course, Joan, if they're empty seats, you know, somebody's figured out that, it, you know, this is the price that we can, hopefully they figured out, this is the price that we can charge if we have more seats that are filled.
Well, I think Delta was sort of a desperation move because I think they got so much bad publicity over the holidays. I think they weren't they the ones that had the snafu? I think we even say it in here. There was a snafu with luggage that didn't move out of an airport to another one that needed to go and mm-hmm. stranded passengers and the like.
I mean, several of them had that problem, not just right, Delta, but I think you're right. It was there was enough blame to go around, I think. And I don't exactly know what happened, but
well, I think U.S. Airways was another one that had the problem, but I guess Delta, I got the impression that Delta was just trying to grab business from the other airlines. Whether they are trying to operate at a level below cost, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not going to help them stave off bankruptcy, which they are close to, they apparently are close to being. But one of the challenges that we've had recently has been people not showing up. What they used to call it, the blue flu?
Oh, yeah.
where some of the employees of US Air, for example, didn't show up, and that's not good for morale for your customers, is it?
Not at all.
Never mind the employee morale, it's not good for
right.
customer morale. And
right.
So it's going to be interesting. And this is an area, Joan, that we all have a stake in, because most people at some time in their life need to get from point A to point B in an airplane.
That's right.
In a commercial airplane. So, folks, this is something you might want to watch for. And you know, take advantage of those lower fares if you can. I know one thing we're going to over the next couple of months. Stand by, Joan. We're going to take a quick break. It's 20 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. When we come back, we're going to talk about a gun policy. Do you have one in your business? Kiplinger says you should. Ahead, Rich Gaylor is going to join us. Rich is, as you know, folks, is a member of our Brain Trust. And Rich just got back from a trip down to South Asia. Joan Pride is our guest, folks, as you know. And Joan, Rich just got back from parts of India. I'm not sure if he went to any place else, but he's going to be giving us a report tomorrow on what he found down there. And so that's going to be pretty interesting to hear what he has to say.
I would think so.
Yeah. So, folks, you won't miss that. That's coming up tomorrow. Joan, by the way, I want to remind people how they can find your publications. The first, folks, you can go to their website, kiplinger.com, KIPLINGER.com. And I hope you go there to that website just because it's a good website. There are a lot of free stuff there. But, Joan, you guys also have your publication is the Kiplinger Letter, now in its 82nd year, which it comes every week on Friday by email or by mail. I get it on Monday in the mail. And then you also have the three biweekly letters, the Tax Letter, the California Letter, and the Agriculture Letter. And then you got a magazine, too, don't you?
That's right, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
Yeah, and tell us what's in that magazine, Joan.
Well, just a lot of articles to help you figure out not only finances, stock purchases, but a lot of other neat stuff. Just, you know, everything from buying the best digital camera to financing your kids' college education.
Finding good colleges. I think you guys talk about that, too. And
yep, and buying a good car.
Exactly. A lot of good stuff there, folks, for your personal finances. And all of those can be subscribed to at the website, kiplinger.com. They've got a 30-day free trial that they'll let you take advantage of. But, Joan, go ahead and give us that phone number, too, please.
Right. Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
All right, folks. I hope you'll take advantage of that. And folks, one of the things I think you'll like, if you're a small business owner, I know the patriarch of the organization now, Mr. Austin Kiplinger, and Joan obviously does. And, Joan, he thinks like the folks at the top of Kiplinger think like small business owners, don't they? I mean, that's...
Well, because they are small business owners.
That's right. That's right. You guys are small businesses in a sea of big fish, and I really admire what the folks at Kiplinger do. Joan, in the news recently, this week actually, there's been the news of people, men showing up at work and killing people with guns.
Yes.
And that's happened since you guys published this note here to employers. Then the question is, do you have a gun policy? Tell us what that means.
Well, do you have a gun policy means that you need to determine whether you're going to allow or not allow your employees to carry concealed weapons.
Even though it's legal to do that in 30 states, as you point out.
That's right. I mean, it's really not the legality that you have to worry about. It's the liability if something were to happen in the workplace with one of those guns.
So you're saying even though you have a permit to carry a weapon concealed in your pocket or on your person, in your purse, for example, you need to know, you need to have a policy, or you need to think about whether you need a policy that says, I don't care what the government says, no handguns or no weapons allowed on the property.
Right. I mean, well, plenty of things are legal in the privacy of one's home, for example, that aren't legal in a workplace.
Right, or in your car or whatever.
Right, right.
I mean, and there are people walking around beside you right now who have legal handguns in their purses or in their pockets, and you don't even know about it. They're sitting next to you in a restaurant.
Oh, boy.
In 30 states.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, and never mind the potential harm that this can do, someone can do with their weapons, either intentionally or accidentally, Joan. You know, if you want to strictly look at this as the owner, without that policy, you could be in a that policy could be a little bit of protection for you in the case of an event where you can say, look, we did what we could.
That's right.
We took the steps. Every employee knew that they had to sign a no handgun policy or no gun policy, no guns in the workplace policy, and this person violated that. So it sort of gives you a little protection in the case of a lawsuit, doesn't it?
Oh, it certainly does.
And hopefully it makes your other employees, the people who are not likely to bring a gun on the premises, feel safer. And so
right.
Something you might want to look at, folks. Talk to your lawyer about that. Joan, let's move over to page 3 and talk about Medicare and Social Security. You guys say, yeah, Social Security is a problem, but it's not the bad one. Medicare is.
Well, and think about Medicare spending, how much it's surging, and how many more older folks we're going to have in the coming years, and you have kind of a recipe for disaster. We're saying the Medicare Trust Fund is going to be empty by 2019, and that's not that far away.
Mm-mm. So basically, we've got Social Security and Medicare heading for a train wreck that's demographically assured, isn't it?
Boy, I don't see how you avoid it.
Demographic, because the people of my generation, Joan, and the generation that you're almost in, the baby boomers, you know, as we get older, there are 80 million of us. And so, Joan, it's going to take some leadership, isn't it, to fix this?
Yeah, and it's not even on the politicians' radar screen at this point, as we're saying. They're not even going to look at it this year.
Well, you know, Joan, even if you don't like what Mr. Bush is proposing, and regardless of if you're a realist and you look at you believe that we are challenged with in the future with Social Security and Medicare, you gotta admire his leadership for saying, guys, we can't let this go any longer. This is my idea for how to fix it. If you don't like it, come up with a better idea. You got to admire that. There's no question about that. We're going to take a quick break. It's 10 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. Stay with us. We're back at 7 till. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and we're talking about the most recent Kiplinger letter. And Joan, over on page 3, there's some new regulations in that you guys are expecting that we will see relative to small businesses being affected by the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which was passed a couple of years ago in knee-jerk response to all the corporate malfeasance that went on. And so tell us what that's going to be.
Well, what we expect to have happen is that we're not saying Sarbanes-Oxley is going to be repealed or anything like that, but we're saying it's going to be tweaked in order to help small businesses. We don't have any details yet, or we don't have a lot of details, but the SEC, which is in charge of this law, is going to be looking at this and proposing remedies late in the year. But we are saying that some financial reporting requirements are going to be scaled back, so that should, I would think, help the cost factor.
Well, here's what's happening, Joan. When Sarbanes-Oxley happened, by the way, folks, this is a law that was passed bipartisan bill. It was passed in less than 90 days. Anytime Congress says anything that quick, look out. And I wrote about this when it was happening. I warned people about it. Joan, every one of the guys who committed the crimes against their shareholders and against their employees and their customers, WorldCom, Enron, et cetera, every one of those guys broke laws that were already in existence. We didn't need any new laws to prosecute those guys or to prosecute any future guys. But the government said, we got to do something. You know, we got to make something happen. And so they passed the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, which put a lot of extra restrictions on public companies, but all of that, all of those things were also overlaid in on smaller companies.
Smaller public, but only public companies.
But especially with regard to audits, Joan, because see what happened, all that filters down into smaller companies. See, when Sarbanes-Oxley hit, audit expenses went up for everybody, including
right.
small businesses who right. aren't even involved in these in any of these malfeasance issues. They can't be because they're not publicly traded.
Right.
And so it's wound up hurting and including me. A lot of people predicted that the Sarbanes-Oxley was going to hurt small businesses. And so what's happening is they're seeing this 2 years later, 3 years later, and they're making some adjustments.
Right.
So hopefully that's happening. And folks, if you're interested in that, check your own industry trade group or the NFIB or the Small Business Entrepreneur Council. Check out those guys and see what they're doing to help with this. And stay tuned for Kiplinger, because I know you guys will continue to report on this, Joan.
That's right.
What's the news on business telemarketers?
Well, there's actually some good news that they're going to get some regulatory relief, that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is going to fix a mistake, which is, boy, I can hardly believe what I'm reading here, the federal government actually fixing a mistake. But they had placed restrictions on pre-recorded marketing calls. But now they're going to lift those restrictions and not make them apply to any situations where you've already have a relationship with the person who's receiving the call.
Right. So if you already have what's called permission to market to these people, then you're okay under that law. And then there's another one, Joan, about the contract set-asides. Tell us about that.
Oh, right. Well, they're going to be eyeballed more closely. I guess what they're saying is that too many small firms are getting special treatment and winning big contracts, but then are bought by bigger corporations. So, in effect, small firms aren't really getting the contracts.
Right.
So they're going to try to work on that and see how they can fix that.
There are three areas of the SBA, Joan, that's having an impact in all three of these reg changes that you're talking about. The Office of Advocacy helps to prevent overbearing regulations, overreaching regulations before they become laws and before they become promulgated as regulations. The Office of Ombudsman at the SBA goes in after the fact like this Sarbanes-Oxley issue and tries to fix things that have become overbearing after they've become law. And third, the issue with the contracts, Joan, that's the SBA's business matchmaking events are taking place to help small businesses, real small businesses like mine and yours, to go in and get business from these big companies and in the unbundling of these large contracts. So hats off to the SBA, Joan, for the work that they're doing here in these areas, these regulation areas.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Joan, thank you for being here. Good job today. And
thank you, Jim.
And we'll see you next week.
Sounds great.
You can't wait, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm waiting.
Thanks, Joe. See you next time.
Okay.
Got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you and also some more heroes of mine. Everybody standing a post around the world on behalf of freedom. God bless you. God be with you. We're very proud of you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.